This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Day. We'll have reporters that have covered some major stories in Northwest Indiana for you to talk about the stories and their work on those. They include, from the Times of Northwest Indiana, State House reporter Dan Carden, Porter County reporter Bob Casarda, and business reporter Joseph Peet. And we'll also have as well, too, some comments about a very special event happening in Porter County this weekend. Taking a look at some of the stories here in Northwest Indiana that has come out from the Times, and in particular from Dan Carden, who is the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. He's based out of the State House in Indianapolis. And Dan, thanks for being with us on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday.
Happy to be here.
Well, first off here, a lot of the stories that you had in the paper and online this week have to do with the decision and announcement earlier this week by the Distress Unit Appeals Board to name the emergency manager organization that is going to be working with the Gary Community Schools to deal with their fiscal and academic problems. Let's take first a look at how the DUAB voted.
Yeah, that vote came down on Monday, and it was a 4-0 decision to pick Peggy Hinckley, name her from Schererville. She's originally from Gary. She's a former superintendent in Hobart and in LaPorte and in Indianapolis. So she's going to be the emergency manager. She's going to be backed up by a company called the MGT Consulting Group out of Florida. And they're going to work together with the Distressed Unit Board to try and fix the finances of Gary Schools. As you know, the budget is perpetually out of balance. They have more than $100 million in debt, and it's a really kind of an unsustainable situation long term. So the idea is, let's put somebody in with all the power. So Peggy Hinckley will be effectively the superintendent of the district and the school board, and she can go in under the state's authority and make whatever changes are needed. She can renegotiate contracts. She can cut spending. She can change the academic program, and there's some talk of sort of reshaping that. And one of the things, to that point, one of the things that they've want to do, that the DUAB especially wants them to do, is to get more students into the schools.
Mm-hmm.
So part of Gary's problem is it's losing a lot of students to charter schools and voucher schools. And in Indiana, where the money follows the child, that's $8,000 per kid that's going to another school. So even if Gary could get 100 kids back, that's almost $1 million that they'd have to spend within the district again.
And certainly, even with $1 million, you'd still have a lot of money to be able to help pay down some of the debt after you figure the expenses for the added students and buildings and the like too. And we know, of course, that's one of the big problems that the Gary Community Schools faces, is they have this citywide district and only what, about 5,000 students in the school district, and all of these closed up, unfortunately, or boarded up, certainly, school buildings all around the city. And some of them have gone to some good use for reuse, I guess, even though they're not being used as schools proper. But the idea is that these buildings are out there, and I'm sure that's one of the things, too, that Peggy and the team are going to have to look at, and how working with the current school board and with Dr. Pruitt, who's still officially the superintendent anyway, how are we going to deal with all these vacant buildings and the like, too, I would imagine.
Well, and not even just the vacant buildings. The existing buildings are in somewhat rough shape,
mm-hmm.
just because the district hasn't had the money to spend on, you know, maintenance and upkeep. And you remember the Theodore Roosevelt's issue with the heat from a couple of years ago.
Right.
That required
right.
an emergency state appropriation to get the heat back on in the middle of winter. So, that is what the emergency manager is going to do. She's empowered to sort of cut through whatever bureaucracy is there and to make the decisions that she hopes or she believes will immediately transform the district.
Now, I know that Peggy Hinckley, as you mentioned, she's from Schererville. She has worked, of course, in school districts and been superintendent of school districts here in Lake Counties. But she's also, been superintendent of some other school districts in Indiana, most notably around Indianapolis, that are predominantly minority-occupied. With a lot of minority enrollments there, so she's very familiar with the problems that the Gary Community School District has.
Correct. Yeah, she was at Warren Township for more than a decade in Marion County. And then she was interim superintendent for the Indianapolis Public Schools, which was on course to sort of be in the same situation as Gary. But her work and the permanent superintendent who succeeded her after an unexpected resignation by the person who came before her has really sort of stabilized that by giving Indianapolis parents a reason to send their kids back to the public schools in the city.
She probably feels very gratified that she's able to help out locally now in a very tough situation for the Gary schools, but probably feels a little uneasy is not the word, perhaps, but a little concerned about the relationship that she will have to have now with Dr. Pruitt as well as with an elected school board. I'm sure even though they understand the situation very well, they're not happy with how this turned out for them.
Well, no. I mean, if you're an elected official, you don't want somebody coming in saying, like, thanks for your service, we're going to take over now. I mean, you want to be the person running things. That's why you ran for the office. That's why you were hired to be superintendent. So, this is the first time Indiana's really done this type of state takeover of an entire district. So it'll be an interesting test case. It'll be closely watched throughout the state.
Oh, I would imagine,
Gary probably is in the worst shape financially, but Muncie is having similar financial problems, and there's a remarkable number of small school districts that have the same kind of out-of-whack budget and high debt tied to declining enrollment, because a lot of school districts, you know, a few years back when we made sure that education money in the state followed the child, a lot of school districts didn't adapt to that right away, or they thought they'd get the kids back, and you know, that money is gone as soon as the kid leaves the district. So, you know, if you lose 20 kids, you're out, you know, two teachers. And the problem is if you lose them across a bunch of different grades, you can't just get rid of two teachers willy-nilly because there's other students to teach. So yeah. It's an interesting situation that a lot of school districts are finding themselves in.
We're talking with Dan Carton, who's a State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And one of the other stories that you had to talk about involves another member of elected officialdom from Northwest Indiana, LaPorte Mayor, or soon-to-be ex-mayor, Blair Milo. She's taking a new job, and she's, in the process of the party is looking for someone to replace her as mayor of LaPorte. Tell us where Blair Milo is going, and tell us, if what you know, at least how things are getting shaped up for this Republican caucus they're going to have in LaPorte.
Sure. Governor Holcomb last week announced that he was appointing Mayor Milo to this new state cabinet position of Secretary of Career Connections and Talent. Part of her job will be overseeing the state personnel office that hires state employees, but the bigger part of her job is going to be sort of an effort to coordinate the various education, training, job placement programs all over the state to try and, you know, grow Indiana's workforce in a time when, you know, we only have 3% unemployment. So the only way to help businesses grow with new employees is to either bring in more people to the state or get people who aren't working the skills and credentials they need to get the jobs that have vacancies. So it's a unique position. It's sort of the first kind of like overarching thing. She's going to be cutting across a lot of different agencies. So, you know, the Department of Workforce Development does some of that. Department of Education does some of that. State Commission on Higher Education does some of that. And she's going to be the person to try and sort of bring all of that together to advance Indiana's workforce.
What she seemed to feel about taking on this responsibility.
Yeah, she was really excited at the governor's press conference. I mean, she said it's something that she's spoken with Governor Holcomb about for a long time. It's something she tried to do in LaPorte, where she was focused on economic development and new jobs. And she thought it was a great opportunity to take that experience and her enthusiasm and apply it statewide.
I understand that there are a number of people back in LaPorte that are very much interested in becoming mayor. And, of course, we now know that the Republican Party in LaPorte is going to be holding a caucus to determine who is going to at least fill the mayor's job for the time being till the next city election. So there are a lot of people that apparently would like to step in as Blair Milo takes this new job.
Yeah, that caucus is going to be on August 11th, and the person who gets selected by the precinct committeemen in LaPorte will finish the last, she got 2.5 years of her term.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a good opportunity for, you know, new leadership in LaPorte. I think Milo was extremely popular. She was easily reelected in 2015. So it'll be interesting to see where LaPorte goes.
Dan, one other story here before we finish up for the day is one that's just come out that's online or in the print newspaper. It's a matter involving a case from Indiana that has been sought some support from the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's a Gary attorney who is on the legal team working on this. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, that's correct. Tony Walker from the Walker Law Group in Gary recently hired the woman from the attorney from Southern Indiana who had been pushing this case through the Indiana Court of Appeals and the Indiana Supreme Court. She joined his law group, so the case is now in part going through his law group. There's the lead attorney is a professor at Northwestern University Law School. The issue really is looking at whether or not police need a warrant to get historical location data from your cell phone provider.
Mm-hmm.
So your cell phone is constantly tracking where you are, in part to, you know, use the network because it needs to know where you are so it can send a signal off of a tower to, you know, make a call or send a text message or use the internet. So cell phone companies keep records of that data. And earlier this year, the Indiana Supreme Court said Hoosiers don't have a privacy expectation in that data because you're voluntarily conveying it to a third party, such as your phone company. So if police ask the phone company for the records of where you were, the phone company is within its rights to provide it without a warrant or without anything else.
Oh. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the U.S. Supreme Court takes up on that here. Any word as to when that the nation's high court's going to get that case, or at least get it in to be able to review the review?
Yeah, well, they filed the petition for review this week.
Mm-hmm.
The court is on recess until October. So the interesting situation is there's a similar case out of Michigan and Ohio that's looking at the exact same issue, but that case had some more complications in it. This one from Indiana is a more of a straight, can police get the records without a warrant? So the attorneys for the Indiana guy are arguing that this case would be a better case to set a clearer precedent.
So Oh, yeah.
It'll be up to the judge. I mean, the justices are interested in because they've already agreed to hear the Michigan and Ohio case. So, you know, whether or not they add the Indiana case to it or substitute it for it, we should probably know later this year.
Dan Carton covers news out of the State House and state government for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Dan, as always, thank you for being with us today to talk about these stories and look forward to having a chance to catch up with you again soon.
Great talking to you.
On this Reporter Roundtable Thursday, let's take a look at what's happening around Porter County. And that means we're turning to Bob Casarda with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Bob, thanks for being with us again today. And let's start right in talking about the great Porter County Fair, which just ended not long ago.
It did. Yes. Eventful fair this year, a few different things. Rabbit being attempted theft of a rabbit again this year. But the big news was the a ride being shut down the same day as a similar ride led to the death of an individual at the state fair in Ohio.
Tell us about that ride. People may have caught the national news and heard something about it. This all started, I guess, the real tragedy is the one death that happened on the ride there at the Ohio State Fair. And I understand now, too, that the Indiana State Fair has basically said the rides will not be, those particular rides that had the problems will not be in effect for this year either.
Yeah, that's right. The Porter County Fair just happened to be underway while that incident happened. And within a very short time, minute they actually heard news about it, the operator of the fair, the rides there shut it down, and then the state did follow then with a order statewide that ride would not be in operation.
What do they, as far as you know, determine or have they determined yet what has caused the problems? Because I haven't seen anything nationally to an update on what caused this ride to go to malfunction basically and go crazy.
Well, I believe it's still under investigation. I know I spoke with the gentleman here with North American Midway Entertainment, based in Indiana, and you know, they've had their ride for quite a number of years, and they said they've never had any issues or problems with it. And I've seen there's a video out there of the incident itself, and there's a breaking of metal and then people flying, you know. So you know, it's still under investigation, though.
I understand that now, of course, the rides are made by the same company, the same type of rides, but obviously it just depends, I suppose, on the ride provider, and I suppose how well they maintain their own safety precautions as well as the industry-wide ones, I would think.
Yeah, sure, and that's, I think, why these folks here were just taking the precaution of shutting this down. Like I said, there was no incidents here of any problems along those lines, but they just wanted to head off any potential.
We're talking with Bob Cassarda with the Times of Northwest Indiana, taking a look at some of the stories that he's covered here for the newspaper, online as well as in print for the week. One of the stories coming out of Porter County government is, I guess, a debate that's continuing here, or seems to have, I guess, continued to plague people who are interested in tax increment financing districts. And the Porter County Council took that issue back up again here lately. Tell us what Councilman Dan Whitten had to say and why it's come back into this particular point.
Well, it's an interesting topic because probably nothing glosses over most eyes is tax increment financing.
Oh, you know,
it's a very heady kind of stuff, and yet it's very important type of things at the same time. And I think that's what was Dan Whitten was shedding light on. There was a report prepared by the Porter County Auditor Vicki Urbanek in preparation for the budget year that showed that $779 million in assessed value of land countywide was expected to be tied up next year in these tax increments financing districts, which basically are geographical areas identified by a community where there's kind of a freeze on any new tax money or any new tax money collected within there. And that money then is siphoned off and used just within that district. So, you know, the overlapping taxing units such as libraries, the counties, schools, do not get any of that increased revenue. It stays captured within there, unless there's a few situations where there's some pass-throughs, as they call them, you know, where some of the money is given off to schools and things to help pass that. But overall, that's the big complaint with it. Proponents say it helps fuel growth in those districts. Opponents say it denies other taxing units. As Dan pointed out, though, these were designed initially to help blighted areas, you know, to help generate within areas. And yet the community here in Porter County that has the largest share of this is Valparaiso. And I think Dan was making the point that the downtown Valparaiso is hardly a blighted area.
Now, I can see where that's the concern here. Like you say, it's kind of strayed from its original intent. And even though it's legal, it's part of the statute, still, I guess the question comes up is whether these funds and these districts, I guess, even get set up and the funds that come captured in these districts that can go to the right places.
Right. So it wasn't settled that night, and it's not going to be settled. This is one of these things that have gone back and forth from the beginning, but I think with the with this report and showing this large amount of property, and Dan is predicting that, you know, maybe rightly, maybe not, you know, that this type of thing, you know, could grow to enough where it does impact people's tax bills and people end up paying a little more in taxes as a result of this captured funds. But that has yet to be seen whether that happens.
Well, finally, a familiar name in Valparaiso politics and government is making a change of jobs here. Tell us what Police Chief Michael Brickner is going to be doing here, going from one agency to another, and his new job coming up.
Yeah, this has been brewing for a bit, kind of behind the scenes. I'd heard about it, but it finally became official last week with the county council approving the pay structure. But Mike Brickner, who's been with he's been chief of Valparaiso Department for 13 years and with the department much longer than that, will be going over to the county and actually heading up a new department over there, kind of a hybrid of the 911 and emergency management. You know, they're bringing those two together, which is the second time in the county government under these commissioners have done that now. They've done that with the Plan Commission and the new Stormwater Department. They've brought them together, they say, out of efficiency and, you know, and just because it makes sense. So they brought these two departments together, and Mike Brickner will be heading that up. That department.
Is this a case where they've noticed how successful the combination of the other agencies with the Plan Commission and Stormwater in turn have worked out compared to what the agencies were like before the change, and then they figured the same will come about here in this case with 911 and the emergency management?
Yeah, I think that's what they're hoping, because you know, I think they're trying to avoid some of the overlap of services. You know, when you've got agencies doing the same type of work, or maybe not as in this area, I think there was some concerns about the amount of communication that was coming out of 911 and emergency management, both with each other, with the commissioners, and then with other emergency units within the county. But this is one of these areas that is a hot, kind of another hot button issue. You know, because you have firefighters and police who are for and or against some of this change. And I've heard from both of them since the story.
I didn't know that's one of the concerns that has come about here. You mentioned about the first responder agencies having trouble trying to communicate with each other sometimes, I guess, depending on what part of the county you're trying to go from or to. And I can see why they're hoping that this will something will come about. Now, Michael Brickner is going to change jobs here during the month. Has he talked about, as far as you know, what he'd like to do or what he knows what he's taking on, certainly. That's the reason he's been selected is because he's very familiar with the 800 megahertz system that's being used now in Porter County.
Right. Yeah, I think he's it's a wait and see type of thing once he gets in there. You know, you've got the former director of the emergency management department, Rush Shirley, who's staying on at this point, but Commissioner Jim Biggs here has made mention that the changes will be expected. And then the old CJ Whitmer, who has resigned now as 911 director, was recently hired over in Lake County. So that's a new development in all this as well.
Now, is he just going to join the staff over in Lake County, or is he taking over the directorship job there?
No, I believe he's among others over at that department.
So he's helping out the staff there too. So. Bob Gasarda is a reporter, covers Porter County government and Porter County News for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Bob, thank you, as always, for helping us out here on Regionally Speaking and talking about the stories that you've covered and that we've put out online as well as in print in the newspaper.
Yes, thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time now to take a look at Northwest Indiana business news of the week. In fact, some of the developments happening almost as we speak here now. It's turned to Joseph Peet, who is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thank you once again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
One of the latest developments now is the ongoing story, literally, I guess, on what is happening with the Strack and Van Til supermarkets with Jeff Strack and his new Indiana Grocery Group. Give us the latest, if you will.
Yes, the closing is scheduled to take place today, where the Indiana Grocery Group will finalize the deal. It's valued at around over $90 million, with all things considered. Part of it is built in that they have to do it as soon as possible. It's going to cost them $200,000 a day if they don't if they aren't able to close right away, because they're getting $8 million worth of credit for closing quickly, because Central Grocers, ever since they filed bankruptcy in May, they have gone to, you know, rely on banks for revolving credit, where they are just borrowing money to kind of keep the lights on in all the remaining stores. And they have an incentive to, you know, stop borrowing that money as soon as possible. It's, you know, it costs interest and so forth from the estate, and that... Strack is, they've been working very hard doing the inventory to get the value of all the, you know, all the food on the shelves and everything to kind of settle on the final price so that they can close this deal. It's expected to revert to control of the local group led by Jeff Strack, the Strack and Van Til families, and the former CEO, Dave Wilkinson, this week.
I noticed that one of the stores the other day you couldn't tell, of course, they were doing inventory, but I could tell on some things that are not included in the inventory, things like frozen ice. You know, that just happened to be the case inside the store. Had a marketing on there mentioning the fact that it was not part of the inventory, so, or at least not of the inventory that apparently they need for the deal to go through.
Oh yes, because yeah, they're gonna the offer that they had is valued at around $91.3 million for everything, including the corporate headquarters in Highland, the commissary in Valpo, the Ultra in Merrillville. But they also they're also gonna have to pay up to $30 million for, you know, the food that's left on the store shelves. Jewel had bid they're gonna pay $70 million for the stores and up to $30 million for the inventory. But the exact amount will be determined by whatever's actually like left on the shelves, and. Yeah, but that's been the big task as far as finalizing. They've already put down a $10 million deposit secure the properties, and it's expected to transfer this week. And Jeff Strack, having talked to him earlier, he was saying that, you know, they're very much looking forward to this, having it revert to local control, and that, you know, they're going to start making changes and kind of run it the way they want as soon as, it's back in their hands. Mm-hmm.
One of the related stories I noticed that also came out in the Times as well, in print and online, the related story is involving, of course, Central Grocers, which was the Joliet-based company that had, up until the changeover here with Indiana Grocery Group, had owned the Strack and Van Til's and the Ultra supermarkets. And of course, they were all slated to be sold, and they were in many cases as part of that deal. But I understand that there is a new company, at least new only in the fact that it's a different company that's going to be handling the Joliet warehousing operations. Tell us how Super Value fits into the equation as far as that part's concerned.
Yes. Initially, too, Super Value had been rumored by the trade publications as one of the potential buyers for Strack and Van Til. Mm-hmm. When it was early on, people had heard, oh, they got sold to Associated Wholesale Grocers. We're hearing all kinds of different things. They're a very large national supermarket chain. They're based in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, just outside of Minneapolis. People might remember they used to own Jewel, but they sold the Jewel Osco's a couple years ago because they've been transitioning from running supermarkets of their own to doing more of kind of a wholesale distribution business. They found that to be a more lucrative, better suited to their strengths, and Central Grocers have been trying to sell that warehouse since December, as well as pretty much all its other assets. They couldn't find any takers, but Super Value finally came through and is buying it out of bankruptcy now. They're looking to expand their presence in the Chicago market. It's a relatively new facility because Central Grocers hadn't always been in Joliet. They've been kind of bounced around the south and southwest suburbs, and they ended up building a new thing out there about a decade ago. Now Super Value is going to buy it for about $60 million. Their biggest interest is expanding throughout the Chicago market because Central Grocers was pretty huge to the market here locally. There are 400. This is the third largest market in the country after, you know, New York and L.A. And then they served over 400 different independent grocers. And now AWG, Associated Wholesale Grocers out of Kansas City, they've taken over a lot of the business from local stores, including the Strax will now be supplied by them. But there's been a lot of business left over for Super Value. And they said in their last quarterly report, they're already seeing results. They, you know, it was already improving their bottom line. They were signing up a lot of new accounts throughout, you know, greater Chicagoland, including in Northwest Indiana.
I was wondering if maybe Jeff Strack and his Indiana Grocery Group was working out in making the details and him taking over the stores, if he was making details with company and Super Value in this particular case here to continue to be their warehouse where they can rely on getting their canned goods and the other private label things.
Oh, they're going to go to Associated Wholesale Grocers out of Kansas City, and they say that'll have some advantages because Central Grocer, part of the reason why Central Grocers ended up going under, they said in the bankruptcies, is because they're kind of relatively small. They had difficulty competing on price with a lot of the bigger companies, and they also weren't able to procure as many like organic items to cater toward people's like changing tastes. And one advantage, AWG is like the biggest for independents in the country and the second biggest overall, and then they're going to be able to radically expand their private label items. They're going to be able to stock a lot more organics, and they're also, another advantage is they're going to be able to stock a lot more of the super cheap items, like the basic generics, where they say it's hopefully going to let them compete better with like Aldi and Save More and some of like the real deep discounters that have made a lot of grounds recently, especially since the Great Recession when people have been penny pinching and so forth, but they're going to start offering more kind of extreme value items and more organics and be able to broaden their selection with a new wholesaler that'll be, it's literally, I think it's over four times the size, or maybe even bigger, but around at least four times the size that Central Grocers was.
Wow.
So they're going to be stocking their shelves with a much bigger company.
That's great. We're talking with Joseph Peep with the Times of Northwest Indiana, one of the business stories here in Northwest Indiana and region for the week. And right now we're talking about the Strachan Van Til Indiana Grocery Group changeover that's underway with the deadline, I guess, today. One question, and you make a note here in one of your stories, I noticed, was and this was part of the discussions that I'm sure Jeff Strachan and company had in preparation to coming up with taking over the offering the bid, to be sure, and the hopes of taking over everything, is having to work out the arrangements with the unions that are representing the employees of the stores that he and the company is taking over. I mentioned in your story about the fact that he had reached agreements with four of the five unions. I'm just curious if we know who the holdout is, so to speak.
That's the story I'm working on. I do not have those details yet, but mm-hmm. No one is objecting in court. No one's trying to block it. So any issues they have are not severe enough where it's they're trying to shut down the deal or anything.
Oh, yeah. Because
the unions do have that right. The laborers attempted initially. They were suing Central Grocers initially to try and save some of the jobs over there when it first filed for bankruptcy. But I need to put in a round of calls to the labor unions mm-hmm. and they seem to be honoring most of the agreements.
I would imagine that they're probably be very, very supportive of this because obviously they're saving the jobs. Maybe it's on a smaller scale than what they had before under the previous owners, but they're still certainly to be happy that the stores will be represented by the union. So it'll be interesting to see that story when you do get it together, Joseph, when it does come out. Let's take a look at some of these other stories that you've taken up, topics you've taken up as well, too.
Just briefly, though, Strax, too, has, like, you know, if you go to the stores in Crown Point or whatever, they usually will, like, use it as part of the marketing, too, and say, like, mm-hmm. oh, we're proudly union, and, you know, because that's something that resonates with people. You know, shoppers here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, you see the labels on the doors as you go into the store, so you know that the union staff that they're being represented there, at least one of the unions, to be sure, is represented there too. So, well, it'll be interesting to see how things shape up here, and I'm sure that everybody in the stores, you'll never see any big changes other than when you'll start seeing more items on the shelves and different labels for the private brand and all that. I'm sure we'll notice that as well too. So we'll look forward to seeing those in the new taken over Strachan Van Til stores to be sure. Looking at other news here, you've covered stories involving the new CEO of U.S. Steel Corporation. A couple stories, in fact, that came out in the Times online and in print about that. Tell us what the new boss of U.S. Steel has to say.
Yes, David Burritt, he is kind of learned from the mistakes of the previous CEO, Mario Longhi, who was, he retired, but it was pretty obvious that he was ousted. And after a disastrous $180 million loss in the first quarter, steel prices have been rising. They've been taking off. There's an expectation of more tariffs, quotas, a further crackdown on the foreign imports that have been, you know, depressing prices and really hurting steelmakers' profitability over the last few years. And then, but U.S. Steel, unfortunately, wasn't in a position. Everyone was expecting they were going to have a great quarter in the first quarter. Prices were finally rising. The market was finally good. And they just stunned analysts and everybody when they had this huge loss because they had been deferring maintenance for all these years as part of their cost cutting, and then the mills were not efficient enough to be able to capitalize off of the higher prices and the higher sales revenue. So he's coming in, he's saying they're going to start investing back in the mills. They're going to spend $1.2 billion in the mills over the next through 2020. They're already doing like $50 million worth of projects at Gary Works. For context, though, you know, often these mills are huge and they're really expensive to reline a blast furnace and that kind of thing. It's not uncommon for, you know, like $100 million or so in maintenance, like a year. But U.S. Steel has been operating very leanly. He's saying, you know, they need to get back to the basics of steelmaking. They need to, invest. He was saying they need to beat the drum on safety, quality, delivery, and cost. And he's talking about the action is kind of at the mills and the steel workers are the ones doing the real work. And he's saying on the conference call that he's going into the offices in Pittsburgh. And if he's seeing, you know, some of his executives there, he's telling him, you know, asking him, are you on vacation? We need to be out at the plants. You know, that's where the action is. We need mm-hmm. to put the focus on the people who are doing the real work and kind of get back to the basics so they're able to deliver. And, you know, that's what's going to guide them to profitability in this, these better market conditions and these higher price that they're at.
One of the other stories, I know you had it related to it, and then the conversation with the CEO talks about, I guess, his views as to whether the United States, and in particular the steel industry in the United States, is having a trade war with any of our other neighboring countries.
Yes, there's been the prices have been rising. They're up over 6% this year. Like U.S. Steel turned a profit of $260 million last quarter. ArcelorMittal turned a profit. A big part of the reason is that the prices have been climbing, but a lot of that is because these imports have captured about a third of the market share. But there's the expectation that there's going to be a further crackdown. It was something that the administration has been trumpeting, but now they have kind of backed up. There was a push by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a lot of business interests, like, don't, you're going to start a trade war if you further crack down on steel. So they've pushed it back. They're not going to go forward with it this time. It hasn't, caused the prices to crater yet or anything, but it's kind of everyone has been expecting further tariffs, and everyone had been expecting, this big crackdown on foreign steel that hasn't materialized. So he was kind of addressing some of these, these economists and these industry groups that are, lobbying for free trade, but it's, the so-called free trade has been really hurting the steel industry for some time. A lot of these are bad actors who are violating our trade deals. They're dumping steel below cost here. They're selling it, deliberately at a loss, the way like Amazon did, with the long-term goal of putting competitors out of business and gaining market share. They are, they have huge foreign subsidies with a lot of the steel. In places like China, the government will literally pay the entire electric bill for the steel mill, which is a huge amount. It takes a lot of energy to operate, blast furnaces. And, then they're selling it here at less than what we're able to produce it for, even though it shipped all around the world, because they have the benefit of these heavy government subsidies that our steelmakers don't get and can't compete with on price. And then so he's been kind of pointing that out and saying, we're basically at a trade war. These foreign steelmakers are basically looking, to put us out of business. They're looking to, they're kind of cheating the rules, and they've been trying to put us under for, some time.
Also, too, in some other developments here in Northwest Indiana, and some new news that's come out that you've reported on as well, too, on the financial scene, some news about some record profits for Horizon Bank.
Yes, absolutely. Horizon Bank, they have been growing. It's been a bit mixed the past couple of years for community banks. You've seen a lot of kind of vanished, but the larger ones have been doing fairly well, and Horizon is definitely one of the larger ones. It's the third highest in market share in Northwest Indiana after Centerre and Chase. They've been growing extensively throughout downstate Indiana and in Michigan. They were able to increase their earnings by 43%, which is huge for a community bank. In the second quarter, they turned a record profit of $9.1 million. They have been expanding. They just opened into the Columbus, Ohio area. They've been growing there. They're now opened a new branch in Grand Rapids. So a lot of it is being driven by just growth of, entering new markets. They've had a strategy where they've been expanding to places like Kalamazoo and Fort Wayne, Grand Rapids, Indianapolis. They're pretty well saturated here, especially in LaPorte and Porter counties. Mm-hmm. But their loans are up overall. They've just seen, they've got more branches now, but they're also seeing a lot of like organic loan growth. The consumer loans are up by 25%. Their commercial loans are up. They're doing a pretty robust business.
We just got a few minutes left here, Joseph. Let's talk about getting back, I guess, to a user of steel. In this case, we're talking about Ford Motor Company. And the locally made police SUVs, there have been some problems, I guess, that the automaker is dealing with. Tell us what you've discovered about that and in the stories that you had in the Times.
Yes, and Ford was also, in their latest earnings report, they were complaining that steel is getting too expensive and it was hurting their bottom line, which is a good thing for our mills and our steelworkers. But the Ford has, they've had some issues with the police interceptor utility, which is made just across the border in Haguish at the Chicago assembly plant there. They're saying the problems are not really the result of anything that's happening at the factory, but of aftermarket modifications, because they soup up these, it's the police interceptor utility is basically a souped-up Explorer where they, you know, have more acceleration, armor, you know, things you need for police work. And then, but there are often a lot of aftermarket modifications where you have to, like, put in, you know, racks and, you know, those types of things, like, after the departments get it. Mm-hmm. And there have been exhaust problems where officers have been smelling exhaust and are potentially being exposed to carbon monoxide. In most recently in San Francisco was reporting problems. There are problems in Austin, Texas. It's happened across the country. But it's not, Ford is saying it's not their issue. It's what's happening is they're drilling holes in the rear to, you know, put up racks or whatever, and that's not being sealed properly.
Yeah.
So exhaust is leaking in that way. But they're offering to pay for it regardless because this is a very big and important business to them. Ford has owned the police market for some time. They had made, of course, the iconic Crown Vicks, which have now basically been supplanted by the police interceptor utility. It's the biggest police vehicle in the country in terms of market share. That and the sedan that they also make there for police use are biggest. So they don't want to alienate this business. They want the police departments across the country to know that they can trust them, that they're reliable, that they're going to take care of any issues that come up. So they've offered to pay to fix any issues caused by the aftermarket modifications. They're encouraging police departments around the country to take any vehicles in with these issues to their dealerships, and they'll, you know, properly seal the holes, they'll recalibrate the air conditioning, they'll check engine codes, they'll look for damaged exhaust manifolds, they'll do whatever it needs to take to rectify this problem.
That's great. Great news, and certainly good news for the law enforcement community, too, that may be concerned about these modifications that maybe a department happened to have when they got some new vehicles in, and they had to have another contractor work on. They get those taken care of, and Ford Motor Company is very generous to take on the expense of that, too. We've been talking with Joseph Pete, who's a business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, on some of the major stories of business import here in the region for the week. Joseph, as always, thank you for spending time with us today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Reporters Roundtable on Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. A nonprofit railroad historical group called the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation has formed a partnership with NICTI, which, of course, is the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, better known as the South Shore Line Operators. And you have a chance to take advantage, beginning this weekend, of the benefit of this partnership. On South Shore Lines, on selected Saturdays, which will include this one coming up, an opportunity to learn more about the communities that this commuter service actually serves. I had a chance to talk recently with the vice president of the foundation, Robert Tabern, about the organization and what these special guides that are called Rail Rangers will be doing on the trains beginning this weekend.
Our docents all have 5 or more years experience of presenting these programs, so that's something we're very excited about. Trails and Rail started out of Chicago in 2000, so it's mm-hmm. been 17 years. They were on several different lines, including the Southwest Chief to La Plata and down to St. Louis up to Minnesota. And we decided to form our own organization, the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, in July of 2015. We're just rolling around with our 2-year anniversary. We mostly do private rail cars on various lines all across the Midwest. And then we decided to do a public rail trip, and we partnered with Iowa Pacific around this time last year and did several months on the Hoosier State between Lafayette and Chicago. Oh. Did several months of programs, and when that ended, the Iowa Pacific ownership of the services ended at the end of February. We approached the South Shore Line and NICTD. They were very open and very excited about having the possibility of continuing those public programs on their trains between Chicago and South Bend.
When you got started with this series, what communities and topics were the ones that seemed to bring the most interest, and in turn you decided to expand from that point?
Well, the South Shore Line is a great line. Hopefully everybody has a chance to ride on it or has taken a ride on it already. It goes from Chicago all the way to South Bend through many northwest Indiana communities like East Chicago. There are several stops in Gary, the Miller neighborhood, all the way over to Michigan City, Beverly Shores, Chesterton, all in there. So there's a lot of interesting stories along the route to share with people. You go actually through 4 different units of the National Park Service as you through or near. four units of the National Park Service between Chicago and South Bend, including I&M Canal, Pullman National Monument, the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, which a lot of people are familiar with, I'm sure, and then the new Kankakee River National Water Trail. So it's quite an interesting route. I can't think of any other train line anywhere in the Midwest that goes near or through four units of the National Park Service.
Now, what kind of logistics are you going through working with NICTI, which is the organization that, of course, owns and runs the South Shore Line, to get things all set up so that they'll have guests on board the trains in addition to the regular passengers?
Yeah, we decided, they've been great to work with, and we decided to do these programs on a select Saturday morning and early afternoon departures in talking with the folks at the railroad, the South Shore Line and ICTD. We decided that, you know, this is probably not for your average commuter who's commuting every day back and forth between Northwest Indiana and Chicago or the South Bend area or Michigan City. We decided to focus on families and also the recreational travelers. There's a lot of stops in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore that people can take the train out to. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of aiming at families. We have a junior ranger program that children can participate in, and also the occasional commuter to get them to see, hey, maybe this is a great way instead of driving, fighting the traffic on the south side of Chicago or the Skyway. This is a great way to get over to see our national park.
Now, you've had a chance to take a look at the schedule and try and pick the days, the select Saturdays that you want to have the guides out there talking with people. Give us the list that you have right now, and are you liable to be able to, if the opportunities present themselves, to add to the list?
Yeah, we decided to start as a test program. We're going to be on through the end of January 2018, so we're going to do this for about 6 months. And then we hope, everybody enjoys it and gets good feedback. We hope that we're able to expand it, become a permanent feature on the train. Our very first program will be on August 5th, and then we'll be doing it several other dates, two in August, two in September, and two in October. And then probably through the holiday season, we'll have our complete schedule up on our website, which is dunespluraltrain.com, or you can check us out on South Shore Line, all one word, .org, and then just click on upcoming trips. Our first big trip, though, is on August the 5th.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that basically you're going to start out from Millennium Station in Chicago with the train from there, and you'll make the eastbound route, and then with a little layover, then you'll go from South Bend to the airport station there and then head back west again. The plan is just basically to do maybe like one trek, or are you going to make more than one round trip, so to speak?
Well, that's exactly it, Chris. We're going to be going from Chicago, because that's where most of our guides live and are based in the Chicagoland area, all the way to South Bend. We leave Chicago about 8:40 in the morning, get to South Bend about 10:12 Eastern time, have a little bit of a layover, then work our way back with the 1:10 p.m. Eastern time train on Saturdays, getting back to Chicago just before 3 o'clock. The nice thing is folks don't have to ride the entire route with us if they don't want to. Of course, they're more than welcome to, but, you could ride just from Chicago to Gary or maybe go, spend some time in the dunes, or you could ride Chicago to Michigan City or ride back. And there's plenty of other options, the trains that won't have guides on them, so you could listen to us one way, maybe spend some time in South Bend or the dunes, and then ride back home on your own schedule of some of the other departures. So we'll just be on that one round trip. It's about six-hour round trip for us.
That is Robert Taburn, who is the vice president of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation. He's talking about the South Shore Line interpretive guides that are going to be on the trains starting this weekend on selected Saturdays, this coming Saturday being the first of the group, and so people can find out more about the communities that are served by the commuter rail service. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And our thanks as well to Dan Carton, Bob Casarda, and Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana for being our guests on this Reporter Roundtable Thursday. Coming up on Monday, we have a conversation with Northwest Indiana community activist Ruth Needleman. We hope you'll join us for that.